Hello, everyone. You're listening to America Meditating Radio. We collect wisdom, inspire each other, and empower hearts on demand 24/7. I'm Sister Jenna, host of the syndicated America Meditating Radio. Join us as we talk one-on-one with leading experts who answer life's most compelling questions, because in a world of uncertainty, we need answers right here, right now. America Meditating Radio, a show for everyone to learn more about this amazing thing called life. Om Shanti. The time that we choose to be aware doesn't necessarily require me to just sit and meditate. But even while I walk and move around, I can be in a meditative awareness, which is awareness of the soul, the original, eternal, imperishable being of light. For a little while, I'd like to invite you to be present, to be here, and to be now. Allow your mind to settle in the moment, to relax. This meditation is about awareness. It's about becoming aware of your original and eternal self. It's about connecting to your truth. Let go of your name. And observe yourself feeling nameless. Let go of your gender to discontinue thinking you're a man or a woman. Let it go and observe how you would feel walking around without a gender. Let go of the role that you play and let go of the titles that you own. Observe how you're feeling as you are gradually letting go. Let go of your religion and put it aside just for now. And let go of your nationality. Hello, everyone. You're listening to America Meditating Radio. We collect wisdom, inspire each other, and empower hearts on demand 24/7. I'm Sister Jenna, host of the syndicated America Meditating Radio. Join us as we talk one-on-one with leading experts who answer life's most compelling questions, because in a world of uncertainty, we need answers right here, right now. America Meditating Radio, a show for everyone to learn more about this amazing thing called life. Shanti. The time that we choose to be aware doesn't necessarily require me to just sit and meditate. But even while I walk and move around, I can be in a meditative awareness, which is awareness of the soul, the original, eternal, imperishable being of light. For a little while, I'd like to invite you to be present, to be here. Allow your mind to settle in the moment, to relax. This meditation is about awareness. It's about becoming aware of your original and eternal self. It's about connecting to your truth. Let go of your name. And observe yourself feeling nameless. Let go of your gender to discontinue thinking you're a man or a woman. Let it go and observe how you would feel walking around without a gender. Let go of the role that you play and let go of the titles that you own. Observe how you're feeling as you are gradually letting go. Let go of your religion and put it aside just for now. And let go of your nationality and even the language that you're accustomed to. Imagine you have no name, gender, role, title, religion, nationality, or even a language. Ask yourself, how do you feel at this moment? And in this feeling, who would think of you and who would you think of? The Supreme Soul would think of you, and you, the liberated soul, would think of the Supreme. In this state of absolute freedom, I am truly who I am. A free, peaceful, pure, immortal, and eternal soul. Allow yourself to just be absorbed in this awareness. This time, Hello, everyone. Welcome to America Meditating Radio. That was Letting Go from the Inclusion Revolution Together with Love album. That was done with the intention of amplifying the importance of each word of our Bill of Rights, Constitution, Preamble, and even E Pluribus Unum. And I believe that if we just remove our attachments to these labels and these identities, we'll be able to actually get the story right. It always gives me great pleasure when you take the time to tune into our show, because it's our pure feelings that we amplify the role of as to why we are here. We are all here to be definitely more benevolent, more thoughtful, more considerate, and definitely more empathetic. There's no doubt that the law of karma plays out who we have become, the mixture of the purest part of ourselves. In Hindi, we call it Satoguni. To this part where it's very rajo, the mixture of there's a pure part in me, but there's also a part of me that is very selfish and driven with motives that are connected to I, me, and mine. And when these both are mixed, it becomes a little bit complex, and we can see that in the world today. But there's a state that I find to be even more concerning, and that's the state of the tamaguni state, where we're such in a state of ignorance that we don't even feel the pain of the suffering that we impose on the lives of others. And thank God for the role of women and mothers, and not to say that we don't go through that. We do. However, I've observed that there is a nurturing, understanding, patient form that women actually exude in the way they show up in the world. And again, it concerns me when we become too masculine-driven. The role, the title, the position, all of that can definitely take us back. So the question is, what's our balance? How do we bring God's light and energy into our own narrative that whether we are in a male form or a female form, we can still bring out the virtues and the qualities that are principle-based, you know, things that will, the intentions and words and choices that would be more uplifting for the lives of others. The thing is, the past energies, those past experiences that are sitting in the soul, hold us so strongly that we don't necessarily have the strength to do the holy and the endow and the big and the huge and the power and the benevolent part of ourselves. And this is really the reason why this show exists. It's our aim to be able to offer tools. Whatever background you come from, whatever religious belief that you might be reared in or even convert into, we wish to see you in your empowered state, that you don't allow the past to hold you back to such an extent you can't be your best version. You can't be good enough for you. Understand what I'm saying? So if we can just find some space to be more silent, to find that introspective part of ourselves that gives us awareness and shines light on those areas that are holding us back, that's where your sadness lives. That's where your frustrations are. That's where your doubts and your confusion lives. That if you can at least identify, this isn't my principle, this isn't my dharma, and then shift the way you have understood it, shift the way people have told you what it means, and just go back to your days of innocence, I'm so convinced we'll be able to change the tides that we're in today. It gives me great pleasure to welcome our next guest, Dr. Aparna Ramaswamy. She is a Bharatanatyam dancer and teacher whose first doctoral research was on Natya Yoga. She's linking the practices of Bharatanatyam to the principles of Ashtanga Yoga. But as a counselor and educator, Dr. Ramaswamy utilizes yoga and meditation in counseling people who are struggling with depression, anxiety, and other mood disorders. She completed her second doctorate on the role of yoga and meditation in cultivating mindfulness, humility, and empathy in counselors. She is also a faculty at Johns Hopkins University, teaching counselors to incorporate yoga, meditation, and counseling. And she's here today in her role Shiva Vishnu Temple in Lanham, Maryland. She's here to talk about an upcoming conference, which I'd be privileged to participate in as well. And the title of it is Woman and Dharma, Saints, Scholars, and leaders. It gives me great pleasure to welcome Dr. Aparna Ramaswamy. Hi, welcome. Om Shanti.
Thank you so much for having me on the show, Sister Jenna. Namaste.
I hope you were able to get into your Zen and meditation mode.
It was very helpful to hear not just your voice that was soothing, but also the message that we are in that space where we not only have the opportunity, but the obligation to hold the past and the present as we move into a future.
Yes, exactly. Haven't you noticed how sometimes the experiences that maybe you're not even aware of, you don't have the details, but there's an energy there and it feels like a ball and chain. And despite all of your best efforts, it feels like you just can't get released. If you've ever been there, has there been a particular technique or thought process or even, you know, knowledge of your own personal spiritual or religious path? Have you found that it has pulled you out of it? And if so, what was that?
You know, that sounds like a very deep question. So if I take a moment to gather my thoughts and approach it, each person may approach it differently. Using your word dharma, sometimes I have found that there may be something that I feel I'm drawn to, that I may even think it's mine to do, that ego component that comes in. But not all the things that I want to do is mine to do, or it's time to do it. So for me, what I have found very useful is patience, to be able to sit back and get into that space of quiet and be able to say, I should step into the flow and not necessarily always shift the direction. Sometimes that's necessary. So I think patience has been a virtue that's elusive but essential in navigating that for me.
That's a beautiful one. It's something that I know that the whole world needs right now because, I don't know, we keep running forward, Dr. Ramaswamy, into an unknown future. Some of us think the future is house, paying off all my bills, getting our kids married, finishing this next project that we have on our table. But I think the future is a very deep place internally where we call it the Karmatit stage. You're just no longer affected by the results. You trust that you're coming from a place of good.
You know, when I hear you say that, what I hear is a few things. One is, when you say the future is in us, we are challenging the construct of time and space, that we are not only our past and the present, but also the potential future. So you're absolutely right in observing that when we are stepping into a future, we're carrying all of our past and our present with the responsibility that we are a part of a larger journey. That oftentimes we can't force, but we can be not just an active participant, but also an agent of change, except we don't always get to dictate the change or the outcome, which of course many of our scriptures talk about in various religious forms. But it's that dedication to the process, dedication to giving it our all, without attachment to where that might take us, with complete confidence that there is a dharmic process that we're all a part of.
Get that. So before we talk about the Woman and Dharma Conference coming up, which I'm looking very forward to participate in, let's hear a little bit about you. How did you get onto your path of meditation, yoga, your studies, and what is Natya Yoga?
Right, and I think to talk a little bit about what is Natya Yoga first is, Natya, of course, is often understood as Indian dance. That would be a good description, but Natya is far more than that. What I mean by that is when you want to understand an emotion of a person, when you want to project, portray, enact someone, whether it's on stage, whether it's in dance, whether it's in theater, you can't act like that person. You can't pretend to be that person. You can't emulate that person. You have to dance that person, almost suggesting it is the process of being that person, even while we know we are not. So it is that ability to straddle both the reality of who we are and have the capacity to simultaneously step entirely into that experience of another. And that juxtaposition of seeming duality was what was elusive to me as a dancer growing up in India. Like many people in that time, we learn dance and we do it as an act, it's performative. There is a shimmering, glimmering, beautiful aspect of us, and it's a performing art, so it does wonders for the ego. But as we go through that process, if we are blessed enough to stay in that process, there comes a point when you realize that's the externality of the experience, that's the perception. So when I settle, step on stage, I'm aware of who I need to be, but my experience is not just that. And I couldn't find the language for what is my experience, because you see, as is common in many world traditions, a lot of the articulation of experience was not written by the performers, were not written by the participants or the dancers. They were oftentimes not scholars. So my research was, what is that experience called? And it took me many places, but finally I came back home. You know, it's like, okay, this is yoga, the experience of oneness, not necessarily uniting, but coexisting. Kind of like, you know, having the two buffaloes come together on a yoke to drive a cart, not necessarily merging, but working together. That to me was what gave me the language to understand my experience of dance, whether it is that somatic artistry and technique of your arms and legs and your eyes and your face, which yoga may call asana, or the various physical aspects of it, combined with the breathing, all dedicated to bring all parts of you in concentration so that you might enter the field of receptive open meditation. So that was Nakya Yoga to me, where the artistry of the form, the Bahiranga as they call it in yoga, of your body, facilitates the Antaranga, the experience of that inner quiet, even amidst that noise and the activity. That juxtaposition allowed me to conceptualize the experience of dancing for the dancer, because that had not been articulated by a dancer before.
Right. I wish I could dance. I
just, you probably do.
You know, sometimes I watch, I don't get a lot of opportunities. We don't even have a television here. But when I get on my flights to India, I get caught up on some of my Indian movies. And I sit there, you know. Of course, I can't move because I'm in my seat. And I watch my little feet and I go, how do they move like that? That is so powerful. And I just go, God, it's such a liberating experience.
You know, and I think, you know, dancing can be with the body. But when I said you probably do dance, if you really look at the experience of dancing, that is something you can do with your eyes closed. You know, the physical form is just a scaffolding that gets you there. It's a lot of fun. But
when I get on the dance floor, everybody disappears. It's just like, even when I'm dancing at the center, poor things, they just pray for me. But I want to move on because, hey, in America, we've got now, gosh, how many different forms of yoga? Last, I think the statistics were about 186 or something different forms of yoga. And I go, wait, you know, dog yoga, you know, this yoga, reggae yoga. And personally, even though I wasn't raised in India, I go to India at least once or twice a year. And I know yoga is something so spiritual, so deep. And I'm not saying the dog yoga isn't it. I spoke to someone the other day. They're now doing goat yoga. And then there's another person that was doing, wine yoga. And I kind of stepped back without judgment, and I wonder, what are they feeling in it? Is it really yoga? What are your thoughts about the various forms of yoga that have now been birthed in the West? How do you feel about it, knowing that yoga in the East has a completely different perspective?
See, and you know, you bring up a very interesting point, and I'm sure this can be addressed in many ways. Yoga is the practice, obviously, but it is also the process and the outcome. It is a sadhana of what you're doing towards that outcome of creating oneness. So we have, of course, in the Eastern traditions, the four kinds of sadhana, jnana yoga, dhyana yoga, bhakti yoga, and karma yoga. You can find that oneness through knowledge, through contemplation, through bhakti, devotion, love, or through action. So there is that scope there. But when you come to the practice of yoga that may have been more evolved in the West, Western constructs, I personally feel like there are multiple practices. And if you look at karma yoga does not involve a practice where you're necessarily doing asana practice. But it is that process of selfless service, very similar to what you're doing, to create that oneness and unity amongst people who clearly are different in their individuality, but brings them together. So if we approach yoga from that perspective, it can include all practices that are extending beyond just the self. It doesn't mean you cannot have self-oriented practices, but there should be a good component of that which involves beyond self, others, the altruistic component of creating that unity or oneness. So if we choose to step into it with that perspective, and if the intention is to create oneness, togetherness, of course we live in a body, we have a mind, and many of us are present and believe that there is something that is not encapsulated within just my body. So if we approach from that perspective, many practices can be yoga as long as we are clear what the intent is. And I find that to be a useful framework to straddle, you know, a very diverse world.
I have to think more about the word that you use, which caught my attention, is that it has evolved as it has come into the West, and I find that very very thought-provoking, and never thought of it that way, so thank you for that. Yoga and meditation. How do you counsel people with depression and mood disorders? What's the benefit?
The benefit is twofold. Yoga, of course, is a physical practice. As a dancer, while the act of dancing or singing or walking or exercise or even formal practices of yoga may not shift the reality of my experience, it does shift my experience of it. My own, as you know, and we've seen this in a very simplistic way, when we feel stuck, whether it is physically stagnant, we're not getting off our couch because we're extremely depressed, or we feel isolated, emotionally stuck, that we are separate from others, just physical activity can be very restorative. And it is also preventive in a very simple way. But of course, if a person has a cultural familiarity and has the openness to learn more systematic kinds of yoga, whether it's breathing, breathing has a way of neuroscientifically altering our experience, and there's numerous research studies that indicate breathing exercises, which are completely inclusive. They're not only for the physical dexterous. They can be done seated. They can be done in any position. Perhaps lying down is hard to do that. But when you have breathing exercises, pranayama, they have a tremendous power in altering the neuroscientific composition and your experience in your brain. So even if you do it at just those levels, they have a tremendous impact on shifting the mood of a person, depression, anxiety, any kind of mood fluctuations. If you go to another level of actually transcending to go into meditation, because ideally, you know, these practices are intended to create a meditative space. If yoga is necessary, if physical practice, asana, is required for you to be able to quiet your mind, some people cannot without that, then you have a regimen by which you develop the physical discipline of some sort of an exercise working towards a meditative zone. In the context of counseling, that is also behavioral modification. People are prescribed to follow a certain set of discipline. And if they do go into meditation, with or without the physical prelude, meditation is extremely restorative, remedial, and preventive. There is research that shows about neural pathways that are laid in the brain that allow you to process trauma from the past, preferred ways of you know, processing an experience where we kind of vivify and exacerbate our own experience because of what life has traumatized us. So meditation, yoga, I think if you understand the philosophy, the practice, the destination, and the multiplicity of inclusive practices that can be meditative, I find it tremendously powerful in teaching the person, the client, to be their own center of change, whether it is behavioral,
yes.
whether it is community, or whether it is meditative.
I really love the way that you look at it. It's beautiful. Let's talk about how it helps to cultivate humility and empathy. Is it because your body is all knotted up?
That would certainly help. Because
that definitely helps.
Of vulnerability. You know, when you are superbly competent everywhere else,
right?
And you can't touch your toe, that is extremely
right.
humble. That would be one way to do it. And I'm sure the physical, you know, they often say that, right? If you have an inflexible mind, working with the body might be a way to get to your mind. As a dancer and as a dance teacher, I've seen that oftentimes the ego is so apparent in the resistance that dancers or dance students might have to the teacher. When they're not able to do something, it is a protective mechanism. It's an ego defense mechanism oftentimes. But when we come to the larger context of what is humility, I approach it more as how is humility defined? It is not so much subservience. It is not so much an absence of pride, because I hope we are all quietly proud of who we are and what we represent to the world, because the dharmic path requires us to be exactly who we are to do what is our dharma. So it is not an absence of that. So humility in the context of what I study was cultural humility. It has the components of we can't really know what it means to be the other. We can imagine, we can speculate, but I don't know what it means to be you, and you cannot know what it means to be me. If we say that, and then we interface the second aspect of you need to be you, more of you, in order for you to accomplish whatever is yours to do in your life, whether you look at it from an ego-influenced self perspective of this is what I want to do in my life, or you look at it from a dharmic perspective or a theological or a religious perspective, that I am here to do something that is not necessarily driven by me. And if you have a purpose that only you can accomplish, as a counselor, I don't want to change you into me.
Right.
Because then you won't be able to accomplish it.
Has any one of us been able to change anyone? Tell the truth. And, I mean, the whole Brahma Kumaris teaching is about that.
Yeah.
Right? So
Clearly
we just can't change anyone. Well, look, I want to talk about the conference because we're running out of time. Sri Vishnu Temple is holding a conference on April 13th. The title of the conference is Women and Dharma, Saints, Scholars, and Leaders. What is this all about, and who can attend?
The conference is Women and Dharma, obviously. It's a bidirectional flow, and it's a narrative we want to create on how have women shaped, influenced, and created Dharma across the centuries, and in turn, how have their Dharmic heritage, background, values, influence them in their choice. So the event is designed to own our past in terms of what have we inherited today, in terms of all the women who have shaped our past. Where are we at today? How are we? Who are the leaders we have in the world today? So we can move towards a future that is more equitable, that is more dharmic. So we have saints. Obviously, people will, if you think about Indian saints, people may think of Mirabai. She was a saint dedicated completely on love for who she believed to be her God, Krishna. When we have scholars, we have many scholars who have spoken up for Dharma. We have scriptures and texts that don't seem to give a consistent message, but despite whatever those texts or scriptures say, we've always had women who have been leaders, whether it's in the arena of religion, academics, or history, whether you have Rani of Jhansi. So there has been that narrative that has always been there. So we are trying to break that narrative out. We're trying to invite, not trying to, we are working on inviting Dharmic women who've pioneered our work across discipline, arts, medicine, religious, institutional leadership, being a leader in families of all sorts of composition, being leaders in science and technology. Women are across the field, in various fields, trying to be a leader. So this event is highlighting the past, the same scholars and leaders, listening to the present in terms of roundtable discussions we have in the morning, where we have multiple stations, where we have women leaders such as yourself, who will be at table sharing how has this field been influenced by women, today's women, what are their challenges, what are their contributions, how is Dharma really playing into it? Is it a value add? Is it an impediment? And what can we do to make it easier, better, so that our women for tomorrow will thrive and benefit as a result of the past and the present?
Beautiful. So for our listeners who may not be very familiar with the concept of Dharma, what is Dharma and what are Dharmic values and virtues? Do you see them still existing today in these times?
That is such a beautiful question. You know, we have a couple of our keynote speakers, Dr. Narayanan and Dr. Reddy, who are giants in this field of Dharmic studies and women's studies. So they present on how, what is Dharma, how have women been Dharmic. So, but to come to your question of today's women, is it relevant? Absolutely. Because some people may say they are Dharmic based on their religion. They may identify themselves as a Hindu, a practitioner of Hinduism, Buddhism, Jainism, Sikhism, that are infused with the values of Dharma. Maybe they have an ethnic heritage, or they have cultural language-speaking groups in India, South Asia, East Asia, where they've been practitioners of Dharmic values. And when we come into what is Dharmic values, there are all kinds of Dharmas. It may be common virtues, my Dharma as a woman, my Dharma as a mother, my Dharma as a dancer, as a teacher, and there may be societal, individual life roles that you have in Dharma. It could come from yoga, where you have restraints of, you know, honesty, nonviolence, not stealing from others. It could just be karma yoga, volunteer services. So Dharma spans religious texts, spans cultural practices, everyday practices. So I don't think it is possible, my personal bias is, it is not possible to do too much good in the world if we did not have the Dharmic disposition of selflessness, service, love, compassion, and infused with whatever else our individual flavor of Dharma is.
Would you also say that it's your deepest core principles?
It can be that.
Yeah.
It can be your principles that are your belief systems, or it could even be stories that you believe in, whether it is from scriptures that you've read. It includes so many different values, virtues, backgrounds, that it can be so many things that you have thought about that influence you in your past. The concept of equity, fairness, I would say is a Dharmic component. So I think it is absolutely present and should be emphasized far more in today's world.
Beautiful. So what are some of the expected outcomes that you and the coordinators have for the Women in Dharma conference coming up on April 13th at Sri Shiva Vishnu Temple?
I think there are many things we would like out of it. At the very least, we want people, this is our story, women and men. It is not just women's stories, so the intended audience is all ages, all genders. We want to share the history of how women have shaped this particular, whatever the field may be, or the Dharmic tradition.
Mm-hmm.
We want people to experience and be exposed to all these women leaders because we may not know. We want people to establish relationships, network. If you are a business leader, connect with other women business leaders. If you are in the healthcare business, connect with women and from that field. So connect and realize there's a whole slew of women there who have all kinds of leadership competencies and contributions they've made. We want to cultivate conversations among these people, and the outcome that we want is what next? Besides emphasizing, showcasing, and celebrating women in these Dharmic fields, we want to also know what can we do as a community to promote women leaders and promote Dharmic values. And as the access community access point in Washington, D.C. for Indian community, how can we be the pioneers for what next? And it's a learning experience for us as organizers, so there are outcomes for the individual, for the speakers, and for us as organizers.
Now, a lot is changing because the souls are changing. Technology has taken us to a completely different dimension of interpretation. That's the best way I can put it. In the West, there's a lot of support in terms of women no longer staying silent if they have been taken advantage of. And also it's happening in the East as well. Predominantly, I think last year there was a big Me Too movement in India. What are your thoughts personally about this whole uprising of Time's Up, the Me Too movement, where women are finding, I don't know if it's courage or if it's just the time that we're in, or if it's because one began to lead the way and they made sacrifices, which brought to light the fact that some women say, I can't stay quiet anymore. There is a big, big sound of women saying, this happened to me, it's not right. That's one. The second thing is the whole dowry system in India. There's been a lot of stuff going on with that. Again, women in the West, we look at it like, wow, they just sold their daughter. You know, and we know there was a lot more to it when it first started. But what are your personal feelings about the role of women today, this being Women's Month? I would love for us to really look at what your interpretation is about the Me Too movement, what's going on with that, and how is it impacting both East and West? And I have a lot of interest about, you know, this whole dowry process that now has changed a lot in India.
You know, that is obviously a vast question. I think that women have been one of the minorities. There are many unrepresented or underrepresented populations, whether it's gender diversity, neurodiversity. There are pockets and large pockets of people who are not as represented. And when we live in a world that is dominated or follows domination principles, we then default into oppression, suppression, and inequity. So for me, when it comes to Me Too movement and all the other inequities that women and other minority groups try to fix, I think it is that concept of truth, for satya, that which needs to be upheld. And it does not come easy, because oftentimes when we explore principles of truth and injury, ahimsa, they can be contradictory. It's very hard to be totally honest, and hence it is brutally honest. There is a nonviolence bit. But as women, I think we have come to that place where there are more number of women, there is more, the media, of course, is able to showcase women better because our communications industry has grown. It doesn't mean that women have not done it before. They may have done it in less numbers, and we may not have known about it, because history also only showcases what it chooses to showcase. So we may be at a time where there is a lot more coverage, there's a lot more visibility of women who are speaking their truth. And I think that is absolutely beautiful that women are able to stand up and speak the truth and call it out and say, this is not equitable, this is not right, this is not fair, this is injurious, this is dominating, oppressive, and repressive to me. I absolutely support it in whatever field, whether it is women, which is what you're asking me about, and other fields of study. And, you know, it is built on the principles of fairness that I think are absolutely essential. And, you know, when it comes to practices like dowry, when dowry is, of course, a practice where families ask for some sort of a monetary or in-kind exchange for the marriage, it is not as common in many communities, and I think socioeconomics plays a part in it, education plays a part in it, but it is prevalent enough because the world is still talking about it. So it's quite possible that even if you were to live in India, you may not know it's happening because it does not happen in your little pocket, but it doesn't mean it's not happening in somebody else's world. And this may be true in all the other marginalized and disenfranchised communities too. We actually have a table for that in the conference too, because we want to hear what are the areas of inequity. So for me, it comes right back to dharma. As people, as women, as minorities, disenfranchised communities, we have the opportunity and the obligation, the responsibility to give voice to that which has not been represented. And to me, that is the core of Dharma. It is active.
Yeah.
It is constantly being shaped.
Yeah. I sometimes find myself, Dr. Ramaswamy, a little bit in between both, that, you know, as a parent, it's a big celebration. I want to give the best to my family, my daughter, and my future son-in-law, and, you know, the large extension that comes with that. And there's also a part in which I want to see, well, if I'm going to spend $1 million on a wedding, maybe it can also go to charity. You know, there are just so many ways that we can look at this. I think it really requires a deeper discussion. Look, I've enjoyed our conversation. Can't wait to see you in April. Tell us about the date, time, and location of the Women in Dharma Conference.
Thank you so much. The event is on Saturday. It starts at 9:30, ends at 2:30. You have the round table in the morning, the keynotes in the afternoon. Any information that you need, you can email me, education@ssvt.org. And you may be able to also find the link both in the PowerPoint that accompanies this talk and other sites. We look forward to having you here. There is no charge. We're always open to event support donations. It's open to all ages, genders. We want you there. We want to hear your opinion. We want to participate with you. And we want you to learn with us. So we hope we'll be able to see you then.
Beautiful. So is the website womenanddharma.wordpress.com?
Yes, it is. And you can also access the parent website at ssvt.org. And the event is in Greenbelt, Maryland. It is an indoor facility, climate controlled. We have a wonderful cafeteria. So please come and spend the morning with us. Of course, you'll see Sister Jenna there with us too.
Dr. Aparna Ramaswamy, it was a delight to have you on the air. And thank you so much. Just well spoken. And you gave a lot of insights for folks who are still looking to learn more about yoga, meditation, and I'm looking forward to seeing you in April.
Thank you so much for having me on your show. Namaste.
Namaste. So, ladies and gentlemen, that was Dr. Aparna Ramaswamy, and if you want more information about the upcoming event that she's coordinating at the Sri Shiva Vishnu Temple, go to womenanddharma.wordpress.com. It's our time. Rise up. Time's up. But also think. Think from a deeper place. Recognize this. So much more to you than meets the eye, and it will take some time to readjust our thinking and our understanding of who we are as women and the way that we show up. But in all reality, we're all souls, male or female. Okay, maybe performance, the body, it's all different, but consciousness, you know, consciously, where are we? We really still need to be empathetic, respectful, kind, generous, curious, but definitely more loveful. Remember, no one can take away your happiness unless you give them permission. And we really are here to love each other the same. And let's shine our light as bright as we can. And here is a beautiful Hindi song in celebration of the upcoming program. Here's Sab Kuch by the Brahma Kumaris. Take care.
I'm Sister Jenna. You've been listening to America Meditating Podcast. You can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and subscribe to our YouTube channel. Did you enjoy that conversation? Because you can also listen to it on Spotify or in iTunes, 24/7, anytime, anywhere. I do trust we all have inner power to become our very best. When we listen with curiosity to learn more, we grow. So thanks so much for tuning in, and do be easy on yourself. Take care.